I'm sure most of you were aware of what was called the Arab Spring, which last year began as a number of uprisings. It began with a little street vendor over in Tunisia who was upset with the corruption in the Tunisian government and how the policemen came and stole all of his fruit and wouldn't pay him for it. So he burned himself to death as a protest, and that started riots. And before long, their corrupt government fell, and then it began to spread to other areas. Primarily, of course, the land of Egypt, the most populous of all the Arab lands, and historically, the area of the King of the South. So tonight I thought it would be appropriate to look at that subject. The King of the South and the King of the North are both, they're talked about a great deal. You'll hear them talked about, and certainly a lot of speculation about the subjects in a lot of religious literature and prophetic material that's out there on the internet and on the airwaves today. It's important that we really understand what happened historically. Tonight we will cover several individuals who historically were the kings of the South and also the kings of the North, and we'll cover what they did, and also then in the account there in Daniel chapter 11, where the time frame changes from the 100s B.C. until the times in which we live. You'll appreciate my Maui mic stand. It is a combination of a Bible, a sweater, and a flipper. So I think you'll see, you've probably never seen that quite before. We want to begin in chapter 10 of Daniel. You probably won't need to have your Bible out because most of these scriptures will be on the PowerPoint. Very quickly, I want to review the 10th chapter of Daniel, which is where we get the prelude to this almost most incredible of all prophecies in Daniel chapter 11. This begins in the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, which is the year 536 B.C., 3 years after Babylon fell in 539 B.C. In the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a revelation was given to Daniel, who was called Belteshazzar. The prelude says in verse 1 of chapter 10, its message was true, and it concerned a great war. That's the way it's translated in the King James. It concerns a great war. This message actually concerns a great series of great wars. And it says, the understanding of the message came to Daniel in a vision. At that time, I, Daniel, mourned for 3 weeks. I ate no choice food, no wine or meat touched my lips. I used no lotions at all until the 3 weeks were over. Now, the end of the 3 weeks was, it says in verse 4, the 24th day of the first month. So this vision took place. Daniel saw it just after the end of the days of unleavened bread in the year 536 B.C. He says, I was standing on the bank of the great river Tigris, and of course the angel Gabriel appears to him. I'll just summarize much of what happens in chapter 10. The angel touched him and says, since the first day you set your hand to fast and pray, I've been trying to come and tell you this vision. He says, but the prince of the Persian kingdom resisted me 21 days. So this spirit being that was giving the Persian kingdom its power resisted him. But Michael, it's interesting, Michael, his name is he who is like God. You think of all the Michaels that are out there today, I don't know too many that would apply to, but that's what the name means. It is one of God's archangels that have scriptural references for us. One of the chief princes came to help me because I was detained there with the king of Persia. He says, now I have come to explain to you what will happen to your people in a time future. That's what we're looking at here in verse 14. The angel tells Daniel, and this is the angel Gabriel, he tells Daniel, what I'm going to tell you in this vision concerns a time yet to come in the future. And the implication is he's really saying it's going to happen at the end time or the end of days. Now, at the very end of the chapter, verse 20, he said, do you know what I have come to you or why I have come to you? Soon I will return to fight against the prince of Persia. So he said, there's going to come some great battles that the spiritual world will be a part of in Persia. When I go, the prince of Greece will come. Now, the prince of Greece, of course, it really was Alexander the Great, or at least the spirit being behind whatever angelic or demonic being was behind Alexander the Great would come. But first I will tell you what is written in the book of truth. Verse 21 of chapter 10 says, okay, these words you are about to hear are written in God's book of truth. So the vision of Daniel 11 is written somewhere in God's book of truth. Now, we have several books that are mentioned in the scriptures that we don't have. We have the book of life. We have the other books that are opened in Revelation 20. But here the angel simply says, what I am giving you is in God's book of truth. And he says, in the first year of Darius the Mede, I stood by my stand to support and protect him. So let's go to Daniel chapter 11 and verse 1. So what the angel Gabriel is saying is that when Darius the Mede miraculously was led into the open gates of Babylon in 539 BC, he was simply saying that other spirit beings were trying to stop him, trying to thwart him, because God was going to use Darius. Remember, 200 years before, Isaiah had prophesied that Darius would be a tool in the hand of God. And Darius the Mede did just have those doors open, the doors of the river Euphrates going through Babylon. His army took Babylon without a fight. And so the greatest nation on the earth at that time fell to Darius the Mede. And it says here, the angel simply says, I stood with him and supported him and protected him that time. So we know that God Almighty had a hand in the fall of Babylon. He directed those events in 539 B.C. so that that decree of Cyrus could go out and the Jews could then rebuild Jerusalem. Now, Darius was the governor of Babylon under the Persian king Cyrus II the Great. So we have some real challenges with the chronology of the Persian kings. And here's one of the first ones that people try to say that Darius was the king of all the Persian Empire. He was not. He was basically a governor of Babylon under the Persian king. The Persians were still much farther to the east as far as their governing headquarters goes. So here we have the first mention in Daniel chapter 11 is that the angel simply says, I was there and I opened the gates. Basically what he's saying is I opened the gates and made sure that Babylon would fall for Darius the Mede. Now then we have the beginning of some incredible prophecies. Daniel 11 contains several things. First place, Daniel 11 contains the history between the Testaments. Some people wonder, why didn't God give us history between Malachi and Matthew? Well, he did, but it's in Daniel chapter 11. He wrote it all in advance, and he knew what was going to happen in advance. This chapter contains, and my memory is a little bit weak here, but I believe it's 142 specific events that were to take place between 300 and 500 years later. So this is the most incredible advanced history ever written. There is nothing anywhere in the world to compare with Daniel chapter 11, except perhaps the large body of prophecies about Jesus Christ's birth, you know, where and the timing and what would happen. Some of the events that happened here are so specific, and they were given in the year 536 B.C., and yet they took place between 200 and 300, 400 years later. They are almost, it's almost beyond belief. Because of this chapter, many Bible critics try to date the writing of the book of Daniel much, much later than it was. They simply cannot deal with the concept that in the year 539 or 536 B.C., so many specific details of history and what people would do were written hundreds of years in advance, so they try to pretend that it was, you know, somehow written after Christ or was written, you know, in the time of maybe, the last events in the book are 162 B.C., basically, so it has to be written after that. And so they're trying to pretend, they're trying to somehow force it into those times. But God was smart. God had much of the book of Daniel written in Chaldee, which was not used by the Jews after 162 B.C. So much of the book is written, proving this was written in a time when the Persian Empire was, in fact, dominant. After the Greeks came into power, the Chaldee language wasn't used much anymore. So just one little sidelight there to show you that God's pretty smart. He had these guys outwitted a long time ago. Now, the first specific prophecy, verse 2, I will show you the truth. There shall stand up yet three kings in Persia, but the fourth shall be far richer than they all, and by his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all the realm of Grecia. Now, Greece at this time was a small backwater. Persia was fabulously powerful. There were going to be four kings. So this first prophecy is about four kings. The first one is Cyrus the Great. Now, Cyrus the Great was certainly a great king. He was not a king who conquered a lot of other parts of the world, but he certainly was the first one of these four that are mentioned. So the first of these kings was Cyrus the Great. He says, after that, other kings will arise. Cyrus, of course, we just talked about, he was one who was over Darius. He was born about 600 B.C., died about 530 B.C., very, very long reign. He left office in 530 B.C., He had a couple of other people that we know of in history, Cambyses and some others. So that's the first of those three, or those four kings. The next one was named Cambyshadar, or Cambyses, the great king. Died about 521 B.C., entered office in 530 B.C. So he's the second king that was prophesied by the angel to Daniel. And he died while en route to put down a rebellion. The third king is called Pseudo-Smerdis. Other name is Guamata. He's a great king. He was very interested in Egypt. He spent much of his time down there, apparently. He entered office in 522 B.C. He also left office very quickly because he was killed by some of his friends, these Persian aristocrats. But he was the son of Cyrus the Great. He basically took the throne because he had this father who, of course, was his great cause to power. Now, Darius, wait a minute here. You know what I'm... Am I? Okay, this is the one. Yeah, okay, Darius here. The great king, king of kings, born 550, died 486 B.C. I may have doubled a couple of these things, so you have to forgive me on this. Xerxes, that's where we want to go. Xerxes is the fourth. He's the great king that would begin to attack Greece. Xerxes lived from 486 to 465 B.C. He was the husband of Esther. The book of Esther is written about Xerxes. If you have the book of Esther handy or notes, you might put down this is her husband. He also wanted to expand to the west, and so he attacked Greece. Now, the vision covers the time from this individual, King Xerxes attacked Greece in 486 B.C., until 167 B.C. So the prophecy of this chapter, chapter 11, basically covers 320 years, 320-year time period that's covered specifically in Daniel chapter 11. This is the fourth king. The tribulation caused by Antiochus Epiphanes began in 167 B.C., and Xerxes, as we mentioned, is the setting of the book of Esther. Now, when this vision came to Daniel, this is the size of the Persian Empire, all the way from Egypt up into Macedonia, but not Greece, and then Asia Minor, what today is Armenia, south of the Caucasus Mountains, and over into the areas where Afghanistan, the areas where modern-day American troops are fighting, and not only in Afghanistan, but also in this area here of Iraq. So this is the Persian Empire at the time when Daniel was speaking. Now, Dan chapter 11 and verse 3, we'll continue with the prophecy here. A mighty king shall stand up and shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. Here we have 129 years later, the mighty king Alexander the Great began to rule with great dominion, as Alexander the Great was the next ruler in history with the dominion larger than Xerxes. And he would do according to his will. Everything he thought to do, he accomplished. There was nothing that he didn't do, or that he wanted to do, that he didn't accept, cross the Indus River. That was where he was finally defeated in battle, and then, of course, he turned back. And most of you know that he invaded Persia, and finally was defeated in 331 at Arbela, and he swept eastward into Afghanistan. He died in Babylon in 323 B.C. at the age of 33. And what's interesting about his death is that he died in the throne room of King Nebuchadnezzar. He died in the same palace, basically sitting on the throne or in a bed kind of right behind the throne of King Nebuchadnezzar. So, you know, Babylon was what he wanted to be. He wanted to dominate Babylon. I think it's just interesting that this world-ruling king, the second one of the four, also died in the world-ruling or the same throne room as the world-ruling government, Babylon. Of course, then when Babylon is resurrected, there's some interesting parallels there. Okay, Alexander's empire then in 323 B.C. when he died, he had, of course, started in Greece, went through Macedonia, he'd crossed the Dardanelles and taken all the way down to Egypt where he saw the vision, you know, went to the sage there that prophesied that he would conquer the entire world. So then he did conquer pretty much all the rest of the entire world. This map shows where he went on all of his routes and finally where he died in Babylon in the year 323 B.C., so that shows the conquest course, and this, of course, is simply a fulfillment of verse 3, that he would go wherever he wanted to go and accomplish whatever he wanted to accomplish. Okay, now verse 4, when he shall stand up, in other words, when he is completely done conquering and he's standing up to reign, his kingdom shall be broken, up at his death. It's in 323 B.C. at the height of his achievements, and will be divided toward the four winds of heaven, and not to his posterity, nor according to his dominion which he ruled. So it did not go to his children. Now, how many know how many children Alexander the Great had? What? He had, yes. Well, that's almost true, yes. That's almost true. It's halfway in between. He actually had, one of his wives was pregnant, and they were hoping that would be a son and a king. And, of course, then he also had some cousins and distant relatives. But essentially, the generals killed his wife and decided to have a fight among themselves. And eventually, his unborn son, it was a son, by the way, they found out, of course, after his mother was killed. Antagonus was the fellow that was kind of the con artist in this whole thing. Maybe that's where we got the word antagonistic. I don't know. That's just a guess on my part. Eventually, though, in a number of years later, by the year 305, about 18 years later, the kingdom was divided up into four kingdoms, north, south, east, and west. So it didn't go to his son or any of his children, or according to the dominion that he ruled, it didn't stay in one piece. It actually was broken up into four different sections. So the kingdom was divided into four parts by 301 B.C., from Egypt, and then we have Ptolemy Soter, then we have Syria, Seleucus Nicanor, then we have Cassander, who took Greece, and Lysimachus, who basically ruled what we have as Asia Minor. So these four generals essentially made a deal. Let's quit fighting and trying to kill each other to see who's going to be the king. This kingdom empire is so vast, and we all have places we'd like to have. And I think that Cassander was always whining about wanting to go home anyway, kind of like what's his name on MASH, that was the guy that dressed up like a girl all the time. If you read some of the history of Alexander and his generals, I think Cassander was the one that was always whining about wanting to go home. So they let him go home and take over Greece. So we have these four generals that divided up Alexander's empire into four parts. So we have the Grecian area, we have Asia Minor, then we have the Ptolemies, which is spelled with a P, but it's pronounced with a T, Ptolemies, that took over, Ptolemy the first, Ptolemy Soter, took over Egypt, up to about the area just south of Jerusalem, and then Seleucus took the biggest piece of the pie. The Seleucidae, or the Seleucids, took all of this area, and they, of course, began to say, well, we're already big and powerful, so we'll make ourselves more big and powerful. Now we have these four winds now of the King of Heaven. Now then in verse 5, we have the first time the term King of the South is mentioned. And it does refer to Ptolemy the First, Soter. His last name was S-O-T-E-R. He was the king over the last area of Egypt, south of the Holy Land. Now just let me give you a little bit of summary here. The King of the South, Soter, the Ptolemies, had 16 regents that sat on the throne. Anyone know who the final regent was? If Ptolemy the First was the first king of the South, who was the last one?
Ptolemy the Sixth.
Who was it?
Ptolemy the Sixth.
Elizabeth Taylor. You're right. You're right. Now, how do we know it was Elizabeth Taylor? No one knows? Yeah, because she was Cleopatra. Yeah, Cleopatra. She died in, what was it, Cleopatra died, of course, in about, 40-something B.C. with when Octavian was taking the throne after the death of Julius Caesar. But Cleopatra was the final Ptolemaic ruler. So some of you Elizabeth Taylor fans, she's historically important for a lot of reasons. But anyway, King of the South, so she was the last regent King of the South, and that may have something to do with Bible prophecy, probably not. But anyway, the King of the South shall be strong, and his kingdom was strong. One of his princes, and he shall be strong above him and shall have dominion, and his dominion shall be a great dominion. Now that's a difficult thing to understand unless you've got a very clear written history, because one of his princes was a guy named Seleucus Nicanor, who had been one of his generals, and Seleucus gained power over Ptolemy and eventually ruled over greater Syria. And so Seleucus' dominion was greater, over much larger than what it had been before. So the first time the King of the South is prophesied is basically saying he and his generals are starting to expand their land and to attack towards the north, because there was an envy between the north and the south. So the first king of the south is Ptolemy Soter. There are some coins of him. He's a very able man. He made Egypt a great power. Seleucus, who was the general that was prophesied in verse 5 with him, took control of Syria, and soon they began a conflict over the control of Judea. So Judea begins to become an area of conflict right off the bat when Alexander's empire is broken into four parts. Okay, now we're in verse 6. At the end of some years, these years, by the way, are about 252 B.C. until about 224 B.C., 29 years after Seleucus' death and after the intervening wars, very, very specific prophecies here that could only have been given by either God who knew ahead of time or, I'm not sure, that's probably the only way. In the end of years, they shall join themselves together, for the king's daughter of the south shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement. So we have a prophecy that one of the Ptolemaic women, one of the daughters of the kings of the south, would come to the north and try to arrange an agreement to have some peace. She's tired of all of these years of war, because now there have been about 30 years of war going back and forth on this border. But she shall not retain the power of the arm. And then it says, neither shall he stand, nor his arm, but she shall be given up, and they that brought her, and he that begat her, and he that strengthened her in these times. So this is a very difficult thing to understand. It's something you really have to know exactly what happened. So let me read you sort of a little summary. It says, they shall draw forces. The king of the south, who was now Ptolemy the Second Philadelphus. So this is Ptolemy the Second Philadelphus. That's this king of the south. And it says, he shall go to the king of the north, who was Antiochus Theos the Second, Antiochus the Second Theos, to make an agreement for peaceful arrangement. In other words, a marriage to seal the alliance, requiring Antiochus to put his former wife Laodice away. So we have the king's daughter coming from the king of the south, but the problem was the king of the north was married. This guy in the king of the north was named Antiochus, and there's a number of guys named Antiochus in the north and a whole bunch of guys named Ptolemy in the south, so you have to kind of put the little Roman numerals after their names. But so we have this king's daughter in the south, says, let's stop all these battles, let's go to the king of the north, I'll marry him. But what happened is the king of the north was already married, and he had a wife named Laodice, but she, the king's daughter, by the way, was named Bernice, shall not retain the power of authority. So Bernice shall be given up. What happened is the king of the north's ex-wife, who was put away, Laodice, got really upset that she was put away, as most of you women would be if somebody else was, you know, forced to marry your husband. You had to get divorced and were turned away. So she ends up killing Bernice. So she didn't retain the power of the arm. So that part was fulfilled. It says, neither shall his authority stand, but she, Bernice, shall be given up in death, and those who came with her. So the people who came with her, those who brought her, were her attendants. She came up from the south to the north, not only by herself, but, you know, a whole retinue of probably 20 or 30 servants or women, whatever it was. And they were all killed by this lady who had been spurned, and whose name was Laodice. Okay, so then her husband and Antiochus were all removed from power by death. So not only did she die, but Laodice ended up poisoning her first husband, Antiochus, who put her away. So this lady was one mean dudette. So she didn't like being put away, so she ended up killing and poisoning everybody. So Antiochus was allegedly poisoned by his repudiated wife, Laodice. Afterwards, she claimed that Antiochus had named her son Seleucus as successor. So not only did she kill everybody else around, but then she announced that, by the way, before I killed him, or she didn't say it that way, that my son, whom I, of course, brought into this world, is going to be the next king. So, and he that begat her, and he that strengthened her in these times. So essentially, what this verse is telling us is some very specific events of betrayal and murder that took place hundreds of years after it was given to us. So now we're down to verse 7. Well, this is kind of a summary I wrote. An attempt to bring peace to the Seleucids and Ptolemies through the marriage failed. After some years, is likely from 312 B.C. to about 352 B.C., so the number of years of war was up around 60 years, back and forth, off and on. About half of those years, of course, were warlike years. Okay, verse 7. Out of a branch of her roots shall one stand up in his estate, which shall come with an army, and he shall enter into the fortress of the king of the north, and shall deal against him and prevail. So we have another king of the south, he's standing up in his estate, comes with an army, and shall enter into the fortress of the king of the north, and shall deal against them, and shall prevail. So a branch of her roots, so in other words, one of her relatives, ended up being her brother, whose name was Ptolemy Eugertes, Eugertes, and he reigned from 246 to 221. So then he came to power down in Egypt, the area of the Ptolemites, and he's the next king of the south that we're dealing with in this series. And he came with an army in 246 B.C. because Bernice called him for help. So Bernice understood she was in trouble, and she calls for help. And here he comes with an army trying to rescue her. He entered the area of Syria's capital, which was Antioch, of the king of the north. Now Seleucus, and dealt with him, or now Seleucus, now it was ruled by Seleucus II Calendus. Now this is obviously a very, you know, just another step in the war, but very, very specific. He came up to avenge some deaths. He didn't like the fact that all these people that had come up there to be in this marriage were killed. So he decides to come and try to avenge his sister who had been killed, of course, by Laodice. So Bernice was gone, and Ptolemy the third Eugertes gets up there with his army and tries to deal with them. Now in verse 8 it mentions he shall carry captives into Egypt. So he actually was able to conquer the capital of Syria, or of the Seleucid kingdom at that time. And he carried away a lot of booty. He carried away captives to Egypt, their gods, their princes, with their precious vessels of silver and of gold. And he shall continue more years than the king of the north. So these three verses are, you know, the stuff of Hollywood, where you have a woman who decides, who's probably put up to leaving the king, the area of the Ptolemites, going up to the north, you know, marrying the king up there that everybody hates, and then that king puts away his wife, and that spurned wife then kills this lady from Egypt, and all of her buddies, and then the lady from Egypt brothers finds out about it, and he leads an army up there and attacks Syria in the north. And so in verse 8, he's coming back with all these precious vessels of silver and gold. Now this is a reoccurring theme in chapter 11 of Daniel, that these guys like to loot, and they need gold, they need power to finance these huge armies, and all of these wars requires a huge amount of money. According to one historian, Ptolemy III carried 2,500 molten images and idolatrous vessels that the Persian emperor Cambyses had taken from Egypt in 526 B.C. So some of these places, you know, these idols, temples, were just full of all of these golden images, and they kind of were transported back and forth by these armies that conquered each other nations over the years. So Ptolemy, the brother of Bernice, who had been killed, came from Egypt up to Syria, and he was the king of the south coming up to the king of the north, and he carried back a huge amount of booty in about 246 B.C. Now, Ptolemy shall continue more years than the king of the south. This is also interesting. Seleucus III, Ptolemy II, ruled until 221, nearly 6 years after the death of the king up in Syria. So just another one of those very specific, prophecies in Daniel chapter 11 that, you know, the critics of Daniel and the critics of the Bible being inspired by God have a difficult time dealing with, because it is so specific. So for some years he will leave the king of the north alone. There's a little bit of a period of peace here because there was some, basically they won the war and nobody else wanted to fight for a while. So this is a picture of Bernice's brother, Ptolemy III, Eugertes, I guess it would be called. He succeeded the Ptolemy Philadelphus II. He invaded the north to avenge his sister's murder. So we do have some good pictures of these guys, leastwise, we have some. They didn't have digital cameras back then. They had to hire sculptors to make something to remember them by. Okay, then the king of the north will invade the realm of the king of the south. So the king of the south had just been invading, and they had won. Now the king of the north says, "Well, after a few years, I'm stronger. I've gotten an army back together. I want to go back and get those treasures and all that gold and bring it back from Egypt." So the king of the north, according to the prophecy, will invade the realm of the king of the south, but then will retreat into his own country. In other words, this is not going to be a successful invasion. Now, the king of the north in this case is a guy named Seleucus III, and in about 235 B.C., he attempted this military advance to the king of the south, which, of course, is the territory ruled by the Ptolemies. But basically, it came to nothing. His war effort failed, and he went back home pretty much in a kind of shame and ignominy. So God knew that ahead of time, and we'll continue the prophecy here that's just so specific and detailed. So to continue, his son shall be stirred up. So Seleucus' sons were not happy with the fact that daddy got his hiney whipped and had to come back home. So they decide they're going to go do some, you know, they're going to get back here. This is a huge story of intrigue and vengeance and taking vengeance and intrigue back and forth and back and forth. So the king of the north then has his sons that are stirred up, and they decide they are going to attack. They assemble a great multitude of forces, and this occurred in about 223 B.C., and they came up, they overflowed and passed through, and it says, he shall return and be stirred up even to his fortress. This was Seleucus III. Name was Soter, S-O-T-E-R. He ruled in Egypt from 226 to 223 B.C., and Antiochus III the Great were the kings of the north. So Seleucus was to the north, and his other son. So these two sons that were all upset in the north assembled a great multitude of forces to come back down because their dad had attacked, and he'd gotten whipped and was chased back home. So they said, we're going to get a bigger army. We're going to go back and avenge daddy. And so these two guys, Seleucus, Soter, and Antiochus III, became the kings of the north. Now, this Antiochus III is a long-lived guy. Notice 223 to 187 B.C. He interfaces with about seven different Ptolemaic kings now that we're going to read about. So the king of the north is Antiochus III, also called Antiochus the Great. He's a very important person in history here for almost 100 years. And what he does is he tries to restore the power to the Seleucidae in the north, to his kingdom, and constantly was trying to conquer the area of Egypt to the south. Okay, let's go on to the next slide. Okay, in those times, this is verse 14, many shall stand up against the king of the south. Also the robbers of your people shall exalt themselves to establish division, but they shall fall. So in verse 14, we have here some... wait a minute. You know what? Let me check something here. I may have gotten... let me check something here. I may have clicked on an earlier version on this thing. We were trying to get this all set up. Let me do this. Let me go to... Well, that should be it right there. Don't worry, the pizza will be here before long. And we'll, okay, let's pop one down. Where were we? To verse... no. Yeah, my apologies here. I want to make sure I get these verses in that I added in. Okay. Okay, here we go. Here we go. Now I'm going to hit F5. Oh, wait a minute. No, does it? Well, we're going to pop it on down then. Bum, 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 bum. Give you a chance to cool off here for a second. Okay, see if we can... Oh, that's much quicker. Okay. Okay, we want to come down to verse 11. Okay, there's the brother. 9, 10. Okay, no, wait a minute. Well, we still didn't get that. Well, we'll just start it here. That's all right. Okay. We'll continue here for sake of time. In those days there shall stand many up against the king of the south, and also the robbers of your people shall exalt themselves to establish division. So Antiochus III made an alliance with Philip of Macedonia and others. And he said he was going to stand up against the king of the south. So Antiochus the Great begins to assemble a lot of other countries around him. And so we all need to conquer these people in the south. Notice, the robbers of your people shall exalt themselves to establish division, but they shall fall. So we have these people who were going to be robbing the Jews. This is the first time that the mention of the the descendants of Daniel's people, essentially the Jews in that area, began to have an alliance. They began to have an alliance with, unfortunately, Antiochus III. And we find that when God's people begin to intermingle with the civil rulers of the land, that there are some very serious consequences. God seems to obviously leave off his supernatural protection, and they then are left to themselves. Verse 15, the king of the north shall come and cast up a mount and take the most fenced cities, and the arms of the south shall not withstand, neither his chosen people, neither shall there be any strength to withstand. So we have in this verse, the king of the north, Antiochus, came, still intent on taking the areas lost to the Egyptian general Scopas, and defeated him in 198 B.C. The battle was at the Battle of Panium. And the Battle of Panium is one that, near the source of the Jordan River. Here's that slide I was trying to find, Daniel chapter 11. Well, we'll just kind of continue here real quickly. Now let's back up a couple kings. The king of the south shall be bitter and come out at him and fight with him, but the king of the north, and he shall send out a great multitude, but the multitude shall be given into his hand. So let's back up now that I have you thoroughly confused. All I have is this slide simply out of the way. So we'll just kind of cover this quickly because this is just more details of these kings of the south that then tried to fight Antiochus III, who for about 60 years was the king of the north and a very powerful king. So the king of the south came out with a great multitude, but of course they didn't win. He was taken up with the multitude, his heart was lifted up, and he shall cast down by many thousands or by thousands much stronger than him. So the king of the north, Antiochus, returned with a great multitude and with a great army, and he assembled a great army towards the south and took the Egyptian territory in 202 B.C. This is called the outbreak of the Fifth Syrian War. Now, Ptolemy Philopater, 221-224 B.C., was moved with rage. A lot of what we find in this chapter are guys who are seeking vengeance or they're angry because they lost and they're trying to attack the king of the north or the king of the south. So in this case, Ptolemy, who was the king of the south. Now, the way you can remember this is because Egypt is spelled with E-G-Y-P-T, and then P-T is the two beginning words of Ptolemy. So two beginning letters, I mean. So the Ptolemies were Egyptians, where the Seleucids were up to the north in Syria. And Seleucid or Seleucidae sounds something like Syria. So in 221 to 224 B.C., this king, Ptolemy the fourth now, Philopater, was moved with rage. He attacked Antiochus III in 217 B.C. He entered Jerusalem, but the Jews would not accept him. He began to hate the Jews and to kill them in Egypt. So he was able to conquer a little bit of Antiochus's territory, but this begins a series of several of these kings of the north and kings of the south who took out their anger on the Jews who were living in Jerusalem or the Jews who were living down in the Alexandria area of Egypt. This is one of the first Ptolemies that did that, Ptolemy Philopater in the 220s B.C. He had a very short-lived victory. He attacked to the north, and of course, he was defeated by the king of the south, and the king of the south then who was Antiochus III. Now, Antiochus III then allied with Syria and helped attack Ptolemy in Egypt. So after Ptolemy came up, Ptolemy IV attacked Jerusalem, and the Jews didn't accept him. He actually took Jerusalem, but the Jews would not allow him, and then he had to hightail it back to Egypt. They would not allow him to plunder the temple. He wanted to take all of the golden treasures and everything of value in Jerusalem back home. They stopped him. The account in Josephus is interesting. The account in the Maccabees, I think, is even more detailed. But he went back home. The Jews then got caught by Egyptian General Scopas, who killed most of them in the winter of 201 to 200 B.C. That's a misprint. It should be 201. So let's kind of summarize what's happening here in this verse, which is basically verse 14. The king of the south, Ptolemy the fourth, attacked the king of the north, Antiochus the Great, Antiochus the third. He won a very temporary battle, and as he was heading back towards Egypt, he was mad at the Jews because they wouldn't give him all his gold and silver. But then as he's heading back, Antiochus the third assembles an army and comes after him. And the Jews are mad because they were taken and they were upset by Ptolemy. And so they decided to join the army of Antiochus III. And as they did, they went down into Egypt. But then Antiochus had another battle coming up, and he took off and left the Jewish people in a garrison down there. and an Egyptian general named General Scopas essentially slaughtered them all in the year 2001 to 200 B.C. During the winter. So a good example that, you know, God's people should rely on God for protection, and they shouldn't be joining themselves with foreign armies, which these Jews did in the year about 201 B.C., trying to exact vengeance. So the Jews got caught by the Egyptian general Scopas there in that time. So in Daniel chapter 11 and verse 15, "Now the king of the north shall come, cast up a siege mount, and take a fortified city." Again, an extremely specific prophecy. "The arms of the king of the south shall not hold out, nor his chosen people, nor will there be any strength to hold out." This was the Battle of Panium, took place a year after the Jews were slaughtered by General Scopas. In 198 B.C., the fortified city was Sidon. The General Scopas essentially holed up in Sidon. He built ramparts around it, but King Antiochus III was able then to conquer the city, and right after the Battle of Pannonium in 198 B.C. So a very specific prophecy here in verse 15 that again was carried out hundreds of years later. Yes. No. No, we'll get to him in a minute. He's actually the grandfather, I believe, of Antiochus the Epiphanes. Antiochus Epiphanes is really a cool character. We got to get to him because he was a prisoner in Rome for 15 years and learned a lot of Roman ways of torturing people and other neat things. So, mostly intrigue. Antiochus III, that comes against him, Ptolemy V, shall do according to his own. Now, this is the next Ptolemy. So, verse 16, we still have Antiochus the Great, but we are now on our next Ptolemaic king. And this fellow, Ptolemy V, I don't know if he has a surname or not. I haven't been able to find one. In other words, so Antiochus then shall come against him, shall do according to his own will, and then shall stand before him, and he shall stand in the glorious land by which his hand shall be consumed. So now we have Antiochus the Great, who decides to take Jerusalem. He has this large army attacking towards the south, so this is the king of the north pushing at the king of the south. And in the process of going down there, Antiochus III took control of Judea. And this is just after the Battle of Pannonium in 198 B.C., so Antiochus III wrestled the control of Judea away from Egypt, and essentially Antiochus III, who's called Antiochus the Great, proved once again that he was able to beat the king of the south. Okay, the story continues. "He shall set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom and upright ones with him." So here we have another group of Jews, another group of God's people that should have stayed out of this, getting involved with some of these armies. "And thus shall he do, he shall give him the daughter of women, who was Cleopatra the First, corrupting her, but she shall not stand on his side, neither before him." Now this is an interesting story. So Antiochus the Third decided, "I'm tired of fighting these Ptolemies. So what I'm going to do is use a woman." He'd probably seen Gone with the Wind or one of them stories. And so he decides to send one of his daughters down there. Her daughter just happened to be named Cleopatra Syra, C-S-Y-R-A, which this is really confusing because the Ptolemies women were all called Cleopatra, but now we've got, and they're the king of the south, but now we've got a king of the north, Antiochus III, and he also has a daughter named Cleopatra. So anyway, that's what she was called. We don't know if she was called that in Syria or after she was sent to Egypt. They gave her that name because it was a name of royalty, and she was to marry into the royal family. So the daughter of Antiochus III was sent down to Egypt, and she was supposed to be married down there and basically be an informer and tell Antiochus what was going on. And the whole thing was supposed to be a trick to somehow get control of Egypt without having to fight for it. And, of course, Antiochus promised a whole section of land in Syria as a dowry. But it didn't work. She shall not stand on his side either before him. Essentially what happened is that she turned against her dad. She kind of liked the guy she was married to, I guess. It happened to my wife, too. may have happened to some of you guys. But at any rate, what happened is, you know, it didn't work. She was actually corrupted by the Ptolemies, and so she didn't stand on his side like she was supposed to. So it was a plan to conquer Egypt and corrupt Egypt and conquer from within. Now, don't forget, God prophesied this hundreds of years before it happened. And so You know, he knew that the this here is Ken Laux. looks a lot like Ken Laux. Ken, you can wave. But they use Ken as the model here. Frantiacus the Great. I just thought you'd like to see a picture of him because he was
way more hair.
Oh. Okay, then in verse 18, after this intrigue down to Egypt didn't work, then Antiochus says he shall turn his face to the coastlands and shall capture many. But a ruler shall make haste for his reproach for, or make cease his reproach for him, but his reproach will return to him. So again, it's almost like it's in another language as it's written to us. But at this point, 195 B.C., Antiochus decides, since this intrigue in Egypt didn't work, now he's getting to be an older guy. You know, a lot of times an older general will try to win one more great battle or conquer one more land to sort of solidify his reputation in history or his, you know, his point in history. So Antiochus decides he is going to attack the islands of Greece and also over into Macedonia. Now the problem with that was that this very fast rising empire called Rome controlled those areas. But they were having a little problem with this guy named Hannibal, who had a bunch of elephants, and they had them snow ski across the Alps, and for about 40 years was marauding up and down the Italian peninsula. Hannibal was never able to conquer Rome, but at the Battle of Cannae, of course, he conquered several major Roman armies with an army much smaller than they had. And so he was sort of running rampant around there, but the Romans were finally squeezing him down into the boot heel of Rome. And Carthage was supposed to send an armada of ships to rescue Hannibal, but as most of you know from your study of the Punic Wars, that didn't happen. The boats never arrived. So what happened is that Antiochus the Great decides that he's going to go rescue Hannibal. So Hannibal then became a guest of Antiochus III. But Antiochus then decides to attack to the east. Whether or not he wanted to have an alliance with Carthage, you know, history doesn't say. It seems that way. It seems like, well, if Hannibal is conquering Rome, you know, Italy and all that area, then I'll start conquering here in the east and we'll carve up this little empire, you know, called Rome, and we'll have it for ourselves. Also known as a really big mistake that Antiochus made. Because by that time, Rome was becoming very, very powerful, and they had learned after their defeats in the Punic Wars, they had some victories, and of course, by this time, you know, they were fulfilling what they knew had to happen, which was the complete eradication of Carthage for them to completely control the Mediterranean. So we have this Romans then defeated the Second Punic War, Hannibal. Hannibal then, he actually became a general or became an advisor to Antiochus and helped him to move some armies through Greece in 192 B.C. But then Antiochus became officially at war with Rome, and this was a real bad thing to do back in that time. But in 197 B.C., good old Antiochus III, the Great, attacked Asia Minor, the Aegean Islands. He gave refuge to Hannibal, who had lost to Rome. So Rome doesn't like this. They send this general named Lucius Cornelius Scipio, you may have heard of him, Asiaticus. Long names here, Lucius Cornelius. They call him, normally in history, he's known as Scipio, General Scipio. And, of course, he defeated Antiochus III at the Battle of Magnesia in 190 B.C. And they eventually had a treaty Antiochus back to his home, basically as a defeated vassal of the Romans. Okay, verse 19. Then he shall turn his face towards the fort of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found. So, having lost everything in these wars, first he gambled conquering Egypt. That didn't happen. Then he gambled trying to conquer the Aegean Islands in Greece and taking some of the Romans. And so he decides to go back to the area in Lebanon and plunder a temple called the Temple of Elymas, or of Bel at Elymais, which is in the area of modern-day Lebanon. And some accountants say that he simply fell. The truth of the matter is he was basically assassinated by his own generals who were tired of being sent into battles they really couldn't win. They didn't want to have a king who would send them into battle against Rome. So just as simply there, he stumbled and fell and could not be found. So this very, very specific prophecy that after he was defeated by the Romans, he would then come back and fall. Now, then we get into some really interesting guys. So now we have this long period of time like 60 years, when Antiochus the Great was the king of the north. And we have these constant series of battles and women going back and forth and these intrigues that are very detailed about the king of this, these various kings of the south that dealt with this long-lived king. Now we have his sons, or at least his replacements. In verse 20, when Antiochus the Great dies, says there shall stand up in his estate a raiser of taxes. His name was Obama. No, not Obama. No, it wasn't Obama. But this guy decides he wants lots of money, probably because he wants to raise another army. And these Seleucid generals are just tired of fighting. They've been fighting now ever since about 320 B.C. And, you know, they get tired of being cannon fodder, or in their case, I suppose, arrow or sword fodder. But they get tired of being killed and going back and forth. So this guy decides to have some, you know, raise some great big taxes. He appointed a guy named Heliodorus as a chancellor to go over and collect taxes. And he came down to seize the treasures in Jerusalem. Second Maccabees tells a story about this fellow's, his name, by the way, was Seleucus Philopater. But he hired this guy named Heliodorus to come down to Jerusalem. And the Jews record in the books of Maccabees a miracle to where this Heliodorus, he essentially realized he was going to die. I think, you know, he was either very, very sick or God was going to kill him or something. But essentially he went back to Seleucus Philopater and says, I couldn't steal all the money in Jerusalem. I couldn't take all of their gold and silver. God prevented me from doing it. So it's an interesting story in 2 Maccabees that historically I think is probably accurate and certainly fairly important. But he ends up dying in 175 B.C. He only reigned about 12 years, so he didn't last too long, but he was a great raiser of taxes. Within a few days or a short time, he was destroyed neither in anger nor in battle. And apparently, he just simply died of a natural cause. So he, again, very, very specific individual prophesied by God. Now we get into a section, verses 21 to 45, describe Antiochus Epiphanes and his crimes. He's the type of the future king of the south. He had spent 14 years in Rome before returning home and taking the throne. He was a brother to Cleopatra of Egypt, who was the Ptolemy. Actually, I think he was more like, he was maybe a half-brother, who died in 172 B.C. This is not Cleopatra of Egypt who had, you know, the affairs with Julius Caesar and later with Octavian and some of the others and then Mark Antony and then died there at the Battle of Actium or right after the Battle of Actium. This is an earlier Cleopatra, but she looks a lot like her granddaughter. You can see that. But let's talk about how we have Antiochus Epiphanes on the scene. We had a question about that. Okay, in verse 21, let's go down to verse 21. There we are. In his estate, so when this great taxer, this fellow that was Seleucus Philopater, dies, in his estate shall stand up a vile person. So it's the first thing that God says about Antiochus Epiphanes the fourth, and that is he would be a vile person. It says, a younger son of Antiochus who had recently returned from being a hostage in Rome. So he'd been a hostage in Rome for 14 years, but they would not give him the honor of the kingdom. So he comes back after his father dies, and his father was this tax raiser fellow. And his father, then he comes in. The Syrian officials wouldn't give him the honor of royalty because Demetrius Soter was still a hostage in Rome. So the older brother was still a hostage in Rome, but this Antiochus says, well, you know, I'm here, I want to be king. And they say, well, yeah, but you got an older brother, and it's his right to be king. So they wouldn't give him the honor of the kingdom. So what he did, Antiochus the Fourth, known as the Epiphanes, he apparently was a very shrewd operator, and he began to obtain the kingdom by flatteries. And there's a long list of the things that he did. He proclaimed himself regent. He began to promise and bribe all sorts of people about all kinds of things. Eventually, he had the rightful king killed over in Rome after having the young Antiochus assassinated. Then Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes then ruled as king beginning in 170 B.C. So we have him obtaining the kingdom by flatteries. Now we go down to verse 22. Well, let's continue on here, verse 22. This is really important. With the arms of a flood, they shall be overthrown from before him and shall be broken. Yes, also the prince of the covenant. It's one of those verses that that's very difficult to understand unless you've got the historical background. So with the arms of a flood, or the force of a flood, it really should be, or just like a big flood hitting them is what it means. he eventually took over. He killed or had killed those who were opposing him, including this Heliodorus fellow that was a tax collector that had gone to Jerusalem. So Antiochus broke those. Essentially, he was the once he got in power, he got the sword out and just started killing everybody. They shall be overflown from before him, and they shall be broken. Yes, also the prince of the covenant. Now, the prince of the covenant in verse 22 is the high priest. Because what he did in intrigue was, there was a fellow named Onias III who was a high priest in 195 to 175 BC when this was going on. Now, he had gone to Antioch to see this new king to try to make sure that the Assyrians would not loot the temple, because they were starting to go in. These soldiers were going in and starting to steal things out of the temple. Antiochus then replaced him with his brother Jason. He just puts this guy, he puts Onias in prison because Jason had bribed him. So Jason was a successor to the high priest, but he was very corrupt. Jason was essentially the high priest from 175 to 172 BC. He was dropped from that position 3 years later after a guy named Menelaus, who offered Antiochus even more money. So when it says they shall be broken, yes, even the prince of the covenant is really referring to this king that comes on with flatteries, and through bribery he was able to infiltrate and essentially stop the work of the high priest in Jerusalem. So the very ruling people who should have known better in Jerusalem were now in league, and they were bribing each other or bribing Antiochus, trying to get to have the office of the high priest. Okay, the high priest Onias III went to Antioch. He is murdered, replaced by Jason, who got the job with bribery. Then 3 years later, he's replaced by another Hellenizing apostate who was Menelaus. So the priesthood at this point is corrupting, or is being corrupt, in Jerusalem. So this individual of intrigue, Antiochus IV Epiphanes, doesn't just come down and attack and destroy. Instead, he is able, through treachery, to corrupt the character of those who should have been God's high priests and should have been serving faithfully in that office in Jerusalem. Now then, verse 23, after the league made with him, he shall work deceitfully, for he shall come up and become strong with a small people. So again, we just simply have, after this league is made by the Jews, because he kind of made this agreement with them and these new high priests that had received these bribes, he came up to them and he worked deceitfully. He continued to make sure all the priesthood were going to be Hellenizers. They began to take on the religion of the Greeks and worshiping Hellas. They began to have these kind of wrestling matches in places they called the gymnasiums. They were not buildings like we have with nets and wooden floors. They were simply marked out areas, more like a soccer field or a round circle that was marked out. And that's where they did their games and their physical competitions. That was called the gymnasium. And they had some of those in Jerusalem. But Antiochus came up strong at first, and became strong with a small people. The small people there apparently is the small group of the priests who should have been the ones who were holding fast against Antiochus and his Hellenizing, but they became corrupt in league with him. So essentially, Antiochus here is tricking the Jews. Verse 23. Verses 24 to 27, he invades Egypt in 169 BC, went as far as Alexandria. Antiochus and Philometor, who was the king of Egypt, both tried to deceive each other. Antiochus returned by way of Jerusalem, joined forces with Hellenizing Jews, and killed many people. And this, of course, is the year 169 BC. That's his first foray going down as the king of the north attacking into the king of the south. Now, in verse 24, let's go through this a little more in detail. He entered upon the fattest places of the province. He shall do that which his fathers have not done, nor his fathers' fathers. He shall scatter among the prey and spoil the riches, and shall forecast his devices against the strongholds, even for a period of time. So again, it's written sort of in cryptic language. He proclaimed himself regent. He kind of invaded Galilee, entered peaceably, but once he did there, he began to enforce Hellenism, which is the religion of ancient Greece. And certainly they just completely took over that priestly family. And some of the things that are recorded, of course, in the book of Maccabees, that was a reaction to that, because the Maccabees wanted to restore the priesthood to what it should be. Okay, verse 25, he shall stir up his power and courage against the king of the south with a great army. So again, the story we just mentioned, the summary of, he attacks as a king of the south now. Antiochus IV Epiphanes attacks to the king, as king of the north, attacks to the king of the south with a great army. The king of the south has stirred up in a great battle, and it was kind of a stalemate what took place here. He took down this large army. And by the way, he's attacking his nephew. Ptolemy the fourth or the seventh or the sixth now was his nephew. Ptolemy the sixth is the one who would not stand, for they would have devising plans against him. They shall forecast devices against him. In other words, Antiochus Epiphanes would be planning to. What he did is he planned to have a meeting. He planned to have a negotiation and kind of pretend they were having a party and having lots of fun and try to somehow then take control of Egypt. So he marched south. The king of the north did, Antiochus Epiphanes, in 171 B.C. with a huge army. But the Ptolemies, which would be his nephew, Ptolemy the sixth, also had a large army. It says, yesterday that feed of the portion of his meat shall destroy him. His army shall be overflown. Many shall be slain. Both of these kings' hearts shall be able to do mischief. They shall speak lies at one table, but it shall not prosper. Now this is God saying hundreds of years in advance that these two crooks are going to meet together and have dinner and try to tell lies to each other, try to deceive each other. I mean, a very specific prophecy, if there ever was one. And of course, that's exactly what happened. There are several accounts of it in history. Mentioned they shall speak lies at their table, describing an occasion in 174 B.C. when Antiochus the fourth and Ptolemy the sixth both sat in a banquet together. Antiochus pretended to ally himself with the young Ptolemy against his own brother, Eugerdes the second, but each was actually trying to deceive the other. Of course, they were both trying to lie, and it didn't prosper. Eventually, of course, the war broke out. Then he returned home, so it's at the time appointed. He shall return to his own land with great riches. So he got some booty out of Egypt, but not, of course, what he wanted to. And his heart was moved against the Holy Covenant. And he shall do exploits and return to his own land. So since he was not able to trick the Egyptians, he had to go back to Syria. And it's really a kind of a shameful thing. It's embarrassing for a king to go out with an army and to come back empty-handed. So in order to bring back some booty, he decides to go into Jerusalem and loot the temple and kill a bunch of Jews. So when he gets back home, he can at least say, well, we won this great victory. And we won't talk about what happened down in Egypt. So that was sad. That's the first time that Antiochus came into the temple there in Jerusalem and killed some Jews. And of course, sadly, the high priesthood was in a league with him, and they let him come in without a fight, and became the beginning of a very difficult and challenging time for the Jews in the 170s, 160s B.C. At the time appointed, which was 168 B.C., he shall return and come towards the south, but it shall not be as the former or as the latter. So in other words, he would come down in there, but he would not have a great victory. So he came to his land in 168 B.C. Then in a little bit later, he returned and went back to the south. So he decided that he heard that the Ptolemies were going to attack him. So here a couple years later, after sacking Jerusalem, Antiochus the fourth, Epiphanes, decides to once again go back towards the south. But this time the Ptolemies had asked for help from the Romans. So we have here the ships of Chittim, which is in verse 30, shall come against him. So Antiochus was grieved, and he came back down to attack the area of Egypt. But we have this Roman general whose name was Pompilius, commander of the Roman fleet, who met him there at Alexandria and asked him if he was going to go home in peace and be a Roman ally like he had agreed to, because he was successor of the agreement under Antiochus the Great, or was he going to attack Egypt? And of course, Antiochus the Fourth said, well, he didn't know, it wasn't some time to think about it. You ever know about that? People want to have time to think about something. So Pompilius takes out his sword and draws a circle in the sand around Antiochus there on the beach at Alexandria. And he says, by the time you walk out of this circle, I will have my answer. And so he either had to have the answer of, yes, I'm going to go home with my tail between my legs and become a humble servant of Rome, or I'm going to attack Egypt. And by the way, if I do that, the Romans are going to kill me. So he was very embarrassed. The ships of Rome came against him. Therefore, he shall be grieved. So he came back home furious. He was angry because of what the Ptolemites had done. They had called for help from Rome. He was angry at what the Romans had done. So he decides to then vent his anger against the Jews. He shall be grieved in return and have indignation against the Holy Covenant. So shall he do. And he shall return, that's return from Egypt, from Alexandria, back to his home, and have intelligence with them that forsake the Holy Covenant. This is an incredibly detailed verse. You have the Romans coming against him in Alexandria. He's grieved because Pompilius told him, you know, embarrass him in public, drew the circle around him, said, you have to give me your answer now. He's going to return. He's going to have indignation against the Jewish covenant with God. Of course, he did some, we'll tell you what he did. So shall he do, and then he shall return back to his home and have intelligence with the high priest. His intelligence was with, he had a lot of interplay with those who were the apostate Jews, who allowed him to come in and persecute the faithful people who were still trying to worship God in Jerusalem. And here's where it gets to be something that applies to us. Egypt received help from Rome. Antiochus' second expedition to Rome, to Egypt, didn't go well. That should be Egypt, not Rome. Roman general Pompilius Laenas came on a fleet and forced Antiochus to leave Egypt there in 166, 167 or so B.C. Returning in shame through Judea, Antiochus vented his fury on the Jews, forced many to adopt Greek religion and Hellenistic gods, and he made the Jews who were going to adopt Hellenism, they had to undergo some sort of operation to become, you know, re-circumcised or re-uncircumcised, whatever it was. I don't want to go into details about what they did, but just to understand it was a very difficult, oppressive rulership that he was going to enforce on them. On the way, he desecrated the temple. He sacrificed a pig. Apparently, he sacrificed this pig on the altar that was supposed to be, of course, only for clean animals, only done by the priests. He then boiled the pig and sprayed the water all over everything in the temple, all of its rooms, all of its furniture. So everything was completely defiled. He stopped the daily sacrifices and the daily ongoing worship of God. He placed the abomination of desolation in the temple itself, in the holy place. It was an image of the Greek god Zeus. He wanted the people of Jerusalem to say, you are all now Jews. You're not Jews anymore, you're Greeks. And you're going to worship the Greek god Zeus. So this event, which was caused because he was coming back from Egypt, embarrassed because of the Roman general Pompilius, he desecrates the temple, sacrifices this pig. He makes sure that the daily sacrifices are stopped, that the priests who wanted to continue doing those were all murdered. In fact, most of them were murdered there in the temple because they refused to give up. It's a sad story. It's in the book of Maccabees. Also, Josephus accounts it, but I believe upwards of 400 of them were butchered there in front of the altar as that pig was being sacrificed on the altar. So that's the original abomination of desolation. And, of course, it took place in 167 B.C. Continuing the story, arms shall stand on his part. They shall pollute the sanctuary of strength, which is the abomination of desolation. They sacrificed a pig there. They took away the daily sacrifice. They shall place the abomination that makes desolate. So verse 31 is very specific, and it was very specifically carried out by Antiochus the fourth Epiphanes, who sent troops to Jerusalem in a fit of anger. They desecrated the temple. They stopped the sacrifices. They set up an altar, or on the altar there in the holy place. Now in verse 32, such as do wickedly against the covenant shall he corrupt by flatteries. Okay, so he did inveigle the priesthood. He was able to corrupt those who were high priests, the families of Jason and Menelaus and others. But the people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits. This verse is the pivotal verse of Daniel 11. It does refer to the Maccabees, who under Judas Maccabee and his followers were able, after a series of one of the original guerrilla wars in history, they were able to defeat the Greeks. But this verse is also understood because it's prophesied that the people of God at the end shall be strong and do exploits. In fact, this verse is essentially repeated in chapter 12, the next verse in Daniel, saying that at the end those that are wise shall understand and do great exploits. So this verse is recognized as the pivotal chapter where the time frame changes from 167 B.C. to the time of the end. So we have this entire chronological story of all of these kings of the north and all of these kings of the south and how they're fighting each other. And I apologize for going through it so quickly, but you can go back and review this. We have some excellent material on our website with the Bible reading program, handouts, and various things. But the important thing is to understand this is a pivotal verse where what is given to us now in the rest of the chapter doesn't concern 167 B.C. and those original kings of the north and the south, but events that are going to take place much later. Just historically, to remind you, some of the Greeks or Jews joined the Greeks, but Judas Maccabee led a revolt, which eventually was victorious. And here we have the chronological prophecy comes to an end, and it jumps forward many years to what's called the end times. Okay, then in verse 33, those who understand among the people shall teach many. Now, that didn't happen in 167 B.C. They lived in caves. They lived out in the hills. They essentially carried on about a seven-year guerrilla war. They weren't teaching anybody. It took them a number of years before they finally reconquered Jerusalem, Judas and his followers, and began to have the sacrifices reinstituted and the temple once again cleansed and began to work again. So those who understand among the people and teaching many has to refer to a time in the future, which would be our time. And hopefully we are all helping fulfill that and have a part in it. It says, yet they shall fall by the sword and by flame and by exile and spoil for days. Now, some of that may refer to some of those Christians who have lost their lives as martyrs in previous years. It may refer to the events that are yet ahead of us. Verse 34, when they stumble, they shall be helped with a little help, but many will join to them with hypocrisy. When you read these verses, keep in mind just how specific the first 32 verses were. I mean, we're talking about women having little fits and killing each other and guys sitting across the table trying to lie to each other and prophesied hundreds and hundreds of years before. So these are very specific things that are being said that are going to happen at a time in the future. That when God's people begin to stumble, probably in the time of Jacob's trouble, the time when the persecution is being enforced by the beast power, that they shall be helped with a little help. God will be here to help us. But many will join them. So there will be intrigue, just like there was with Antiochus, how Antiochus corrupted the Jewish leadership of the 160s and 170s B.C. is a type of a future type of corruption. Many will join them with hypocrisy. Verse 35, many of those who understand shall stumble to refine and purge them. Many prophecies in the New Testament about a purging and a time of being refined in the fire, especially the Laodiceans and others. And to be made white to the time of the end. In fact, that's almost a quote out of Revelation 3 about the Laodicean church. Because it is still for the appointed time. So these verses say very plainly, this is for the appointed time later. Remember, the first appointed time was the first abomination of desolation. When it says, we go back about 8 verses, what, to verse 16, it says, it is for the appointed time. That was the year 168 B.C., which began the events of Antiochus Epiphanes, that his two trips down into Egypt, the second time back, of course, in humility or in embarrassment, where he then caused the abomination of desolation to be placed. So the second appointed time, we don't know what it is yet. We don't know what year it is. But we know that we can learn a lot from the first appointed time about what's going to happen in the second. Daniel 11, verse 36, the king shall do according to his will. This is the coming king that we don't know much about him yet. In fact, it doesn't tell us anything. It just says this king shall do according to his will. We don't really know who he is yet. But we know that Antiochus Epiphanes is a type, a forerunner of this man who is coming, who will be king. He shall exalt himself above every god. He shall speak marvelous things against the God of gods, shall prosper until the fury is fulfilled for that which is decreed shall be done. So Daniel chapter 11 and verse 36 is essentially, this is a summary of the beast of Daniel, Revelation 13 through 16. This great beast shall do according to his will. He shall magnify himself for a short time. He shall speak against the God of gods. He shall try to convince all the armies of the earth to stop with the returning Jesus Christ. So he shall prosper until the fury is fulfilled. So God will allow this for a short time, until the fury of the beast is fulfilled, or until the fury of the seven last plagues, God's fury, is fulfilled. Verse 40, at the end time, the king of the south shall butt at him. So now we're back talking about the king of the north and the king of the south. The king of the north shall come against him like a tempest. So let's go back where we were. Now we find out the next verse tells us that this is a king of the north. Now this verse didn't tell us that, neither did this one, but and the king, when you read that in Daniel 11, verse 36, you wonder, well, who is that? The next verse tells you, at the end of the time, the king of the south shall butt at him. That goes back to the antecedent, which was that king. The king of the north, which is the guy we were just talking about, obviously the coming beast power, shall come against him like a tempest. So the king of the north will swoop down like a tempest with chariots, horsemen, and with many ships, shall enter into the countries, shall overflow and pass over, shall also enter the glorious land, which of course is the land of Palestine, the land of Judah, Judea. Many shall be stumbled, but these shall escape out of his hand, Edom, Moab, and the chief of the sons of Adam, or of Ammon. So it tells us, even when this huge army comes down, this king of the north swoops into the king of the south, that the areas of modern-day Jordan and Edom shall escape. News out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him. So after he's in that area, the glorious land, he begins to hear that an army is coming at him from the east and the north, which would be the army of 200 million, perhaps, coming from the east, as in Revelation 16, or the north, maybe some of the armies that would be part of the former Soviet Union area. Then he will go out with great fury to destroy and devote many to destruction. So this is, I think, the third woe, this massive, huge battle that begins to take place. But in verse 45, he shall plant his palace between the seas in the glorious mountain. This probably takes place all at once. In the glorious mountain, so he shall plant his palace on Mount Zion, and that's where he shall come to his end, and none shall help him. So this beast power will basically relocate his headquarters as he swoops into the Middle East, set up his world administration in Jerusalem on Mount Zion, and that's where he's going to meet his end. Now, in Matthew 24, it mentions the gospel of the kingdom shall be preached to the world for a witness, and the end shall come. Then in verse 15, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, we just read that, standing in the holy place, whoever reads, let him understand. Well, what Christ is saying is you better understand what Daniel was talking about. And so as we understand, Antiochus Epiphanes, this sort of crazy Syrian general, Seleucid king, who was angry because he was not able to conquer Egypt as he wanted to, and then took his vengeance out on the Jews in Jerusalem, and he had intrigue with them. He removed the high priests through intrigue and through deceit and lies. And then he desecrated the temple. He stopped all the daily worship, the daily sacrifices, and then he also set up this statue of Zeus. When you see those something similar to that happen, because Christ said you'd better understand this when it does, then he says, of course, you better flee to the mountains. Now, what is an abomination? That word is used, I think, a number of times. Solomon went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Zidonians, and after Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. An abomination is an idol. It is a representation of something false to be worshipped, Ashtoreth or Milcom, but they are called the abominations. Jeremiah 7, verse 30, the children of Judah have done evil in my sight. They have set their abominations in the house, which is called by my name, to pollute it. So they have put, the people of Judah had put various symbols of Tammuz, the crosses and various other symbols of Tammuz, and mother and child in the temple during the time of Jeremiah. Ezekiel 7, as for the beauty of his ornament, he set it in majesty, but they made the images of their abominations and their detestable things therein. So the abomination, according to the Bible, has to be an image, has to be an idol, has to be a statue of false worship of some kind. Ezekiel 8, he said to me, lift up your eyes now towards the north. I lifted up my eyes towards the north, and behold, the gate of the altar of this image of jealousy was there. So in this chapter of Ezekiel, Ezekiel is being taken on a tour of the temple, and the angel basically is pointing out to him all of these abominations. He says, see what they do now, even great abominations that the house of Israel commits. He says, turn again, I will show you even greater abominations. And so abominations are essentially these images and these idols that are put into the walls. Here they're described as, I went and saw every form of creeping things, abominable beast, and the idols of the house of Israel. Now, I'm showing the statue. Anyone know where the statue is today and who it is? Right, St. Peter in Rome. Anyone know who it originally was? Well, it may have been Jupiter Olympus. It also may have been Janus, J-A-N-U-S. Janus was the Roman god of keys, and this guy's got some keys. I think he's holding a key somewhere. He has his finger up in the air. He's either testing the wind or something. But anyway, it's probably Jupiter Olympus. I mean, I would guess the statue has been named a number of different things. But the Pope has said many times that wherever this statue is where the seat of the Catholic Church is where the seat of the Roman, essentially the Holy Roman Empire. So if they ever take Jerusalem as we understand prophecy, and we see this statue then taken down and placed on Mount Zion, then I would assume that we could probably pretty much understand that that would be the modern-day fulfillment of the abomination of desolation. At least if he had to ask me, you know, give me in 10 seconds, tell me how it's going to happen, that's would be my best guess. We already read Daniel chapter 11 and verse 33, they that understand among the people shall instruct many. And that's our job today. We should be teaching as many people as we can. Some will be purged and made white. Some are going to fall, perhaps in the Great Tribulation, or perhaps describing the Great Tribulation. But these things ought to be a real warning for all of us that we have a serious work to do. And, of course, time is very, very short. Just continuing about this same individual, he shall not regard the God of his fathers, nor the desire of women, so he will not even respect children, nor regard any god, for he shall magnify himself above all. So the man of sin, the beast power that's coming, will magnify himself as being God upon the earth. He shall honor the God of forces. He shall do these things in the strongholds. In other words, having a great military power. And I think you're probably pretty familiar with most of these verses. So Daniel chapter 11, verse 36 to 39, they don't apply to Antiochus. The time period switched in verse 32, and they are a prophecy for the future for our time. Paul wrote, "Let no one deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come except there is a great falling away." And the next step is the man of sin is revealed. Now, I think many of us could argue we've seen a great falling away and a number of fallings away in addition to that. So the next step would be the man of sin being revealed, who will be the son of perdition. He'll oppose and exalt himself above all that is called God, very similar to the wording in Daniel 11, or that is worship. So he sits in the temple of God, or sits in Jerusalem, where the temple of God used to sit, showing himself that he is God. Now, he cannot sit in a physical temple rebuilt today by the Jews. That would be the temple of the Jews, not the temple of God. It's only the temple of God if God was there, or if God built it. The temple of God today is the church. This simply cannot be, scripturally speaking, any building built by man today. But he's sitting where the temple of God used to be in Jerusalem. And I think that's what Paul was talking about, showing himself that he is God. And of course, when Paul wrote this, there was a temple in Jerusalem on Mount Zion. It had not been destroyed yet. So the future man of sin in verses 9 to 11 then describes his tactics and the things that he's going to be doing. His coming is after the working of Satan. Satan's going to give him his power, and with all lies and wonders. He'll be deceivable and righteousness and those that are perishing, people that don't love the truth, because if they did, they might be saved. And then the whole world will be sent a strong delusion and will believe the lie. Okay, we got this. This is kind of a repeat of what we've seen, the sequence of events here. And then, we'll just continue on. I think for sake of time, the pizza will be here in about a half hour, but I think we'll just kind of continue, make an end here because we've been an hour and a half. Okay, before 45. So the headquarters of the beast power sits there in Jerusalem. Antiochus didn't do that. He essentially left the corrupt Jews in charge. And then Revelation 13, I stood upon the sand of the sea, saw the beast rise, having seven heads and 10 horns, and upon his horns 10 crowns, and of course upon his head's name of blasphemy. And this beast has all of the aspects of the earlier Roman Empire and Greek Empire and Persian Empire and Babylonian Empire. And then, of course, eventually the final repercussion of that, or the final manifestation of that, 3.5 years, 42 months, where he simply has complete control over all the earth, at least all the earth that he wants to have control over. And he blasphemes God. He fulfills everything Antiochus did, only much more. And he makes war with the saints in a much more powerful way, a much more devastating way than Antiochus did. It was given him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And then that happens in all languages and all nations. Okay, then we have upon his forehead, Mystery of the Babylon Great. I think most of you are familiar with that, that the beast power essentially is a resurrected Babylon. And then we got some more pictures you're familiar with there. And then I think we can probably end here on Daniel chapter 10 and verse 12. Many shall be purified and made white. Hopefully that's a prophecy that all of us are participating in and tried. We've all had trials. We've also had many blessings. Sometimes I think we don't talk about our blessings enough. But the wicked shall do wickedly. That's happening around us every day at all times and all places, it seems like. It seems like we're under siege if we're trying to obey God. None of the wicked shall understand, but the wise shall understand. And I hope with this Bible study you've been able to understand a little more about this most incredible prophecy in the Bible in some ways. Just almost unbelievable. And if you have any questions, feel free to come up and ask me afterwards. I'll be glad to try to help any way I can. But thanks for coming. Hope you have a great feast. We'll see you tomorrow at church.